so size matters. Our fascination with size is on display as soon as babies are born. How much did she weigh? Ooh, my baby weighed 7 pounds and 6 ounces. Oh, that's pretty good, but my son weighed 9 pounds, 2 ounces. Size matters. The next thing you know, those babies grow bigger and bigger and find themselves in a playground. And you know how this discussion goes. Soon they're talking about their fathers. Their mothers too, but more often their fathers, especially if they're little boys. My father is bigger than your father, says the first. Yeah, well, my dad has a bigger truck than your dad. Oh, yeah, well, my dad can beat up your dad, and so on. Next thing you know, those kids are moving on from the playground to bigger salaries, bigger houses, and negotiating bigger retaliatory tariffs or voting for bigger tax cuts, bigger, bigger. Size matters. This week, Kim Jong-un made a speech in which he said, the USA should know that its whole territory is within the range of our North Korean nuclear strike force, and a nuclear button sits on my desk at all times. So President Trump responds, President Trump, right? He's the man with, according to Marco Rubio at least, the man with little hands. He's also the man with the biggest army, biggest navy, biggest air force. But Trump takes the bait and he tweets in the spirit of those playground boys. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on my desk at all times. Well, please inform him I have a nuclear button too, but it is much bigger and more powerful than his button, and my button works. Size matters. Size is a long-standing human obsession, from Stonehenge to the Great Pyramid, from the Titanic to jumbo jets, from Mount Everest's heights to the Grand Canyon's depths. We celebrate big. We take refuge in the ginormous, and we brag about might. Which is why some people care about God's bigness too. They usually want to say that God is really, really, really big. Even today, theologians brag that our God is omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. Omni, in such phrases, practically means big, really big. And Psalm 29, which we just heard Laura read, Psalm 29 is ancient Israel's God version of Trump's, my button is bigger than your button. The little buttons, on the other hand, in this psalm, are all of Canaan's little gods. The psalm works this way. You can see from the handout that's in your bulletin, the first two verses and the last two verses make sort of an envelope structure that introduced the psalm and completed and explain where it's going and where it went. God is greater in these verses, greater in glory and strength. God is greater in holiness. God is greater in kingly power. God sits enthroned like a king over the flood. God is greater even, according to verse 1, than the mighty ones, which, though not clear to us, would have been clear immediately to the Israelites. The mighty ones here are the gods of the Canaanites. God is greater than the gods of the Canaanites. And what follows in verses 3 to 9, inside this envelope, are 7 lines that begin with the voice. And they're centered on verse 6. 7 is the number of completion. The 7 voices are a poetic demonstration of just how big God is. In these verses, God's voice is described as one whose power annihilates those mighty, not so mighty Canaanite gods. So, first slide. There were basically four of these gods that this psalm mocks, little gods of the Canaanites. The first is El. El was the father god, often pictured as a calf or a cow, as in this slide of an idol of El. The Israelites, like, can we move back to the yeah, there we go. The Israelites worshipped El at Mount Sinai, you will remember. They made a golden calf, and that calf was like this, an image of the god El. Now, El, this god, was the main god of the Canaanite pantheon. He had several children. I'll introduce three of them to you. The first one is Yam. Right, if you look closely here, you can see what looks like a seven-headed monster with wavy lines on the back of the monster. That's the sea. El's first child was Yam, the sea, mentioned in verse 3. The Mediterranean Ocean to Israel's east was obviously where the god of the sea lived. Yam was the god of chaos and is often portrayed as a sea monster, as in this slide. Second child of El was Mot, the god of death, who lived in the desert to Israel's northeast. This slide pictures a bone with Mot's Sumerian name inscribed on it in Sumerian, in the Canaanite fashion, although this necklace is actually marketed on the internet for modern pagans. Go figure. Third child of El was Baal, who you all have heard of. Baal was the favorite god of the Canaanites. He was the storm god. Notice that in his right hand he has a club, or sometimes it's shown as lightning. He lived in a palace on Mount Sirion, modern-day Mount Hermon to Israel's north. Baal's always pictured with that club. In Canaanite myth, Baal eventually used that club to defeat both Yam, the sea, and Mot, death, and become the high god of the Canaanites, El not being very interested in people. Now, according to the psalm, these gods all lived outside of Israel's borders, to the northwest, in the sea, on a mountain, in the desert. They were described in the psalm here as foreigners in the most prejudicial way. They're not Israelite gods. They live way beyond us. We know from the Bible, however, that actually Israel's people often worshiped those gods anyway. The psalmists, who wanted all the Israelites to worship one god, the psalmist never got his or her way, actually, because the people of Israel, we read in the Old Testament, were always worshiping those Canaanite gods instead, who had great big parties at their temples and were a lot more fun than the Yahweh god. So these Canaanite gods and others like them from the surrounding nations competed with Israel's god, Yahweh, for the affection of the people of Israel. So according to Psalm 29, the battle between Israel's Yahweh and Canaan's so-called mighty ones is no real contest. So you see in verse 3, you can follow on your handouts, Israel's God thunders over the mighty sea. Yam. In doing so, Yahweh not only defeats Yam, but also usurps the power of Baal, the storm power, in defeating the sea with thunder. In verse 5, God breaks the cedars of Lebanon, where the altars to Baal were always erected in the high places, laying bare Baal's puny power. In verse 6, at the center of the psalm, the theme of the psalm, Israel's God makes Lebanon skip like a calf. Now, this is a poke at the highest of all gods, El, who was a calf, and who was remembered and idealized as a calf. And it makes fun of Sirion, the mountain, that's the wild ox, which is a poke at Baal. So, built right into this psalm is this mocking attitude to the so-called mighty gods of Canaan. In verse 7, God minimizes Baal again by taking control of the flashes of lightning, normally Baal's weapon of choice. And in verse 8, God beats up Mot, the god of death, in the desert of Kadesh. Finally, in verse 9, the voice of the Lord sounds a seventh time, and the oaks are twisted and the forests are stripped bare. Groves of oak trees or other forests and mountainsides were the places of choice for the worship of Baal. So, for example, in Hosea, he condemns the Israelites for their unfaithfulness. They sacrifice on mountaintops and burn offerings on the hills under oak and poplar and terebinth by making Baal's mountain skip in verse 6, by twisting and stripping the forest bare in verse 9. Yahweh mocks Baal's authority. True worshipers of Yahweh gather not in the forests, but as verse 9 says, they gather in the temple in Jerusalem, where they all cry glory. So how does this Trump-like picture of God, where God is bigger, badder, better, much more powerful than the Canaanite gods, with much bigger buttons than any of them, how do you like it? Today is the first Sunday of Epiphany. Epiphany is an ancient Christian holy day that celebrates a very different understanding of God. On Epiphany, we turn the page on the God of bigger buttons. We close that book, and we turn instead to Jesus. And when we look for God in Jesus, rather than in Psalm 29, what we find in the New Testament is actually an evolutionary sea change in how God is understood by people of faith today. That is, if we really want to understand what God is like, we are to listen to his voice, not in thunder, not in carnage, not in bigness, but we are to listen to the voice of God in the unlikely teachings of Jesus. Unlikely. Especially compared to the image of God in Psalm 29. Jesus was born in a stable to an unwed mother. He was a refugee for the first few years of his life, escaping political repression by moving with his family to Egypt. Jesus was not a mover and a shaker, but he was a carpenter, at least for the first few years of his life. Jesus was a preacher who never had the advantage of going to an accredited seminary, a person who devoted his life to comforting the grieving, healing the sick to the degree he could, speaking the truth quietly in little stories, even to deadly power. Jesus was someone who refused to use the law or its upholders to beat down other people, but who insisted instead that the laws were meant to make the lives of regular people better. And if they didn't, the laws were no good. Jesus was someone who was willing to suffer for his convictions, someone who was willing to upend social conventions by eating and drinking and partying with people who otherwise had no friends. Jesus was a teacher whose countercultural voice suggested that rather than beat people up, we ought to turn the other cheek. We ought to believe that a little was enough. We ought to believe that the poor were precious and that our neighbors were actually what it's all about. There is within the Bible this evolutionary development in thinking about what a God could be, would be like. A development that's mirrored pretty much in many forms of modern Baha'i or Hinduism or Judaism. Instead of emphasizing power and might, and destructiveness, omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence, epiphany encourages us to listen to the still, quiet voice of God, to Jesus' voice instead, come what may. This means, in a word, that the Bible is not so much about the power of the biggest God ever, as the Bible is about pursuing shalom and love as our goals, defining justice and mercy as our benchmarks, even if we suffer for doing so along the way. I don't mean by saying all this stuff to suggest or to pretend that power, at least human power, doesn't have a place, or that human power is something that we ought to ignore or never seek. I'm not saying that. Christians are not called to be naive. Just, says Jesus, Christians are called to being gentle as doves while being as wise as snakes. But the message of Epiphany, the message engraved in the ministry of Jesus, is that among all the other things that we can strive for, the greatest of these is always love, no matter what size it comes in. Amen.